Taliban officials say two deadly explosions have hit the Afghan capital, Kabul, with one of them happening in the city's Shia neighborhood. The German chancellor calls the COVID situation in her country dramatic, as France says it is being hit by the fifth wave of the pandemic. And the cost of living in the UK at its highest level in almost a decade, partly driven by higher household energy costs. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital of Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. The Afghan capital of Kabul has been struck by two explosions again, with Taliban sources reporting at least 8 deaths and 15 injuries. The Interior Ministry, in a tweet, said an explosive-laden vehicle ripped through a Shia-majority suburb of Kabul, leaving 1 dead and 6 injured. The second explosion happened elsewhere in the city, but an anonymous Taliban source said the second blast killed 7 people and wounded 9 others. No group or individual has claimed responsibility. Afghanistan has experienced a series of blasts since the Taliban takeover in mid-August. Earlier this week, a Shia-majority neighborhood in the capital was rocked by an explosion. Last month, 2 Shia mosques were also hit by suicide Daesh bombers that left over 120 worshippers dead. Tehran has urged members of the International Atomic Energy Agency to refrain from making hasty comments with political purposes about Iran's nuclear issue. The remark came from the caretaker of Iran's UN mission in Vienna. That after the IAEA, in a report, criticized the Islamic Republic for not granting its inspectors access to reinstall surveillance cameras at a nuclear facility in the city of Karaj near Tehran. Mohammad Reza Ghaibi said Iran regards the agency's access to the centrifuge parts workshop beyond its legal obligations. He said that this is because the Karaj site is still under judicial and security investigations following a terror attack, which Iran blamed on Israel. Earlier, we were joined by our Vienna-based correspondent, Homolesky. She says Iran has already blamed the West and the IAEA for remaining silent on the terror attack against the Karaj nuclear facility.
Now, this is the same facility that came under what Iran called the terrorist or sabotage attack, widely blamed on Israel back in June. And the previous head of Iran's the previous Iranian ambassador to the IAEA, Mr. Gharib Abadi, whose term in office here in Vienna has now come to an end, he had previously asked the agency to clearly and in clear words condemn this terrorist act that's being committed, he said, by Israel. And the fact that the agency has not done so, he said, shows that the Europeans, the Americans, and the IAEA have decided to remain silent on these sabotage attempts. And he was saying that he cannot expect Iran to give the agency access, to give the agency the storage of the camera that was destroyed in an attack by Israel, and at the same time remain silent about this attack and not to condemn the perpetrator of this attack. Iran says that it's still investigating, its security and judicial officials are still investigating the matter, and they want to see if, in fact, Israel did use the IAEA cameras in order to carry out.
Iran has marked the 10th martyrdom anniversary of Hassan Tehrani Moghaddam, known as the father of Iran's missile program, who based the country's defense strategy on missile capabilities. Saman Khujuri reports.
Iran has commemorated the 10th martyrdom anniversary of Hassan Tehrani Moghaddam, a general known for his relentless efforts to develop Iran's missile program. Senior military and state officials attended the ceremony to honor the lofty status of Hassan Tehrani Moghaddam and his unique role in the missile program of the country. Tehrani Moghaddam, an IRGC commander, was a key figure in Iran's ballistic missile program. He helped develop the medium and long-range ballistic missiles. An engineer by profession, he designed the Shahab, Qadr, and Sejil missiles with a range of over 1,000 kilometers. Tehrani Moghaddam began establishing the Iran missile program at the time when the country was under attacks during the 8-year Iraq-imposed war on Iran. He continued his efforts to boost the program in subsequent years amid the difficulties and shortages.
He was truly the father of missile program of the country. Today, Iran's missile industry and its mass production, from the safe missile towns to the development of sophisticated missiles with precise targeting, are all fruits of the efforts made by Tehrani Moghaddam and his colleagues. This has boosted Iran's defensive capability.
Tehwani Mukaddam was killed in an explosion in November 2011 west of Tehran. The blast came during a missile test at a base in Bidgene. At least 16 others were killed in the blast.
Iran's missile program is part of the regional power of Iran, which is to ensure peace, stability, and security in the region. Iran's missile power has never posed any threat to regional countries. Stability is a legacy left behind by Tehrani Mukaddam for the country and the region. Therefore, Iran's missile program is never up for negotiations because this is the fruit of the sacrifices made by our dear martyrs.
As observers say, the West's efforts to stop Iran's missile program over the past years reveal the significance of Tehrani Mukaddam's legacy, which serves as Iran's main power of deterrence.
Tehrani Mukaddam has based Iran's defense strategy on missile capabilities and missile deterrence, a move that effectively removed any military option against the country from the table of the enemies. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Israeli regime continues to break international laws on an almost daily basis, and even though Palestinians have remained steadfast in their opposition and resistance to Israeli policies that have been compared to policies under an apartheid regime, the international community has failed them all along. Laws devised to stop Israel from violating Palestinian rights, like settlement buildings, have repeatedly been broken. And now Israel is cooking up a new scheme, building a new neighborhood in an illegal settlement.
Israel is planning to seize more land from Palestinians. The Israelis are planning to build a new neighborhood in the illegal settlement of Ariel. The new neighborhood is set to be built some 2 kilometers away from the settlement's main residential area. The construction would impede the future expansion of the Palestinian town of Salfit. The first phase of the new neighborhood includes 730 residential units. The construction of Ariel settlement itself was first approved 30 years ago. The 730 residential units planned for the West Ariel in the first phase are part of the plan that Israeli authorities announced last month to build about 1,300 new homes and settlements. An additional plan for West Ariel was approved in the 1990s.
The Israelis consider they have a right to expand their settlements whenever they see fit. And Palestinians, they say, officially have no rights, no democratic rights inside Palestine in terms of their recent Israeli nation state law. So peace is completely impossible.
If it goes ahead, an additional 800 residential units could be built. Israel's plans to build new settlements come amid rising attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians and their properties. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, in its latest report covering the period of October 5 through October 18, documented settlers' actions, which included damaging over 1,600 trees, most of them olive trees, or stealing Palestinians' harvests. These attacks took place in villages neighboring the cities of Nablus, Al-Khalil, Salfit, Ramallah, and Al-Quds.
The Zionists have, from the very beginning, refused to negotiate in any serious way with the Palestinians. They consider they have the military, the diplomatic edge, and really every solution for the Israelis is not peace, but it's a technical ability to dominate and control the Palestinians until they can be expelled. That's been consistent from the beginning until today.
The Fourth Committee of the UN General Assembly recently approved several anti-Israel resolutions covering multiple issues, from settlement buildings to the expulsion of Palestinian families and the demolition of their homes. One UN official has even described the construction of settlements as a war crime. Still, the Tel Aviv remains defiant. And recently, Israel's UN envoy went as far as tearing up a Human Rights Council report at the General Assembly.
More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. Israel has expanded its settlements on Palestinian territories over the years. Israel has many plans to expand other illegal settlements, including building 470 housing units in Pisgat Zeev, almost 200 buildings in Ramat Shlomo, and 500 housing units in Har Homa. After former U.S. President Donald Trump took office in December 2016, Israel stepped up its settlement expansion in defiance of UN Security Council Resolution 2334, which pronounces settlements in the West Bank and Al-Quds a flagrant violation under international law. The administration of U.S. President Biden has practically done nothing to stop Israel's expansionist policies.
Now, the difference between Trump, the monstrous predecessor, and Biden is that Trump openly gloated at Israeli successes and insulted Palestinians at every opportunity. He was playing to his white supremacist electoral base. It's different for Biden. He's in the Democratic Party. But nonetheless, he's still a spokesman for corporate America, and he represents continuity with Obama and also continuity with Trump in a way, because the Israeli embassy, which the American embassy, which Trump moved to Jerusalem, remains in Jerusalem. It's continuity with American policy towards Israel since 1967.
The Biden administration appears neither willing nor interested in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law as they are built on occupied land. The UN Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent Palestinian state, with East Al-Quds as its capital.
The COVID-19 pandemic continues to wreak havoc across Europe, with several countries on the continent reporting a record increase in their daily cases and deaths. The French government spokesperson says the country is being hit by a fifth wave of COVID infections. Gabriel Attal noted that Paris is not planning extra measures to fight the virus. In Russia, officials report about 1,250 deaths, a new one-day record for the country. Also, over 36,000 new daily cases were logged. The Czech Republic is another European country struggling with an uptick in infections. Health officials there reported more than 22,000 new cases, the highest daily tally since the pandemic began. Meanwhile, the German chancellor warns of a dramatic coronavirus situation in her country.
The present pandemic situation is dramatic. I can't put it any other way. The fourth wave has hit our country with full force. And even though there is no more legal ground for the pandemic national emergency situation, I have no doubt that we are in the midst of such an emergency situation.
Merkel also said that the upward trend in COVID cases, fatalities, and patients being taken to intensive care units is, quote, frightening. The chancellor also pointed out the country's urgent need to progress on vaccinations. The official cumulative number of infections in Germany has now surpassed 5,144,000, while the death toll stands at over 98,000. Hospitals in many European countries are filled with patients and health systems struggling to cope with the crisis. Britons are paying a lot more for food, fuel, and accommodation, with the country's inflation rate surging to a 10-year high last month. The annual rate has jumped to 4.2%. That's the highest level since November 2011. And that's more than double the target set by the Bank of England. Increased household energy bills, a rise in the cost of secondhand cars and fuel, and higher prices in restaurants and hotels are blamed for the surge. The reported spike in inflation prompted a drop in UK stocks compared to their European peers on Wednesday. Earlier we talked to our correspondent in London, Syed Puruza, who told us more about the reasons behind the rising inflation in the United Kingdom.
These numbers mean that the inflation rate has risen, and it's probably going to continue rising. This, of course, comes months after a warning from the Bank of England governor, Andrew Bailey, who said that the inflation rate was going to rise in the coming months, but that it would be temporary, although there are a lot of other people who are saying that it will not be temporary. But how did we get here? The reasons can be sought in many different places. Some are related to the pandemic, others are not related to the pandemic. Some are a direct result of Brexit. For example, we saw the shortage of those semiconductor microchips that are used in cars, in smartphones, washing machines, and a lot of the other stuff that we use on a daily basis. And then in September, we had the truck driver shortages, a direct result of Brexit, those European drivers who left post-Brexit, never to come back.
Bleak winter ahead for Europeans. The continent is battling a record-breaking surge in natural gas prices amid a severe energy crunch. The price of gas in the Netherlands for next month is now over 101 euros per megawatt hour. the highest since October the 18th. This follows reports that Germany's energy regulator had suspended the approval process for a major new pipeline, Nord Stream 2, bringing Russian gas into Europe. The increase in energy costs has already pushed up inflation in several European countries. The crisis is said to be driven by other factors as well, including a gradual phasing out of coal, as well as higher demand due to the lifting of coronavirus-related restrictions in several countries. An envoy of the Venezuelan government was kidnapped last year in the African island of Cape Verde on a U.S. arrest warrant. Alex Saab was extradited to the United States last month to face trial on corruption allegations. We have reached out to his wife, Camilla Fabry, to hear more about Saab's condition. She is very critical of the way that her husband was treated by the Cape Verde government.
The experience of him in Cape Verde was horrible, and he was tortured every single day, not only physical but also psychologist torture. Also, Alex is a survivor of cancer. The government of Cabo Verde never authorized the access of his medical of medical specialist to see him.
Fabi says the treatment came despite calls by international organizations to release Saab or to stop his extradition. She says that Saab was an envoy on a humanitarian mission and his political immunity had to be respected. But the Cape Verde government was ignorant of all of that and preferred to collaborate with the U.S. Fabi believes this was all set up to pile pressure on the Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and to oust him from power. On Monday, Saab pleaded not guilty in a federal court in the U.S., after a judge dropped several money laundering charges against him. He is now facing a single charge. Caracas calls Saab's detention a kidnapping case. It has also suspended the talks with the opposition on ending the political crisis in Venezuela. Saab was a member of that negotiating team. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Satellite analysis over the past 20 years by the U.S. National Aeronautics and Space Administration's Ames Research Laboratory proves that China has contributed more to greening the planet than any other country in the world. We'll prepare for you an article written jointly by KJ No and Michael Wong. The piece is titled China Offers Solutions to Climate Change. Greenhouse gas concentrations are driving catastrophic climate change and creating an existential threat to the planet. But there is a way out. Last year, Chinese President Xi Jinping pledged that China's carbon dioxide emissions would peak before 2030 and that the country would become carbon neutral by 2060. China has a history of setting ambitious, nearly impossible goals and then achieving them, often before deadline, so this pledge is significant. Under the Communist Party of China, Beijing has already created an economic miracle in transforming China into the largest economy in the world. It ended extreme poverty while creating the largest middle class in the world. It has virtually eradicated COVID-19 through non-pharmaceutical methods, while vaccinating up to 20 million people daily and pledging the largest number of vaccines, 2.2 billion, and distributing more than a billion to the rest of the world. It has also been applying similar focus and national resolve to tackle climate change. China has the greatest program of adopting renewable energy of any country. It generates more renewable power than North, Central, and South America, 42 countries combined. It has more solar parks and wind farms than any other country in the world. Last year, it established more wind power than the rest of the world combined. It has more electric vehicles than any other country. It operates 420,000 electric buses, 99% of the world's total. The city of Shenzhen alone has 16,000 e-buses and 22,000 e-taxis. It aims to have 325 million electric vehicles operating by 2050. Its high-speed rail network spanning 38,000 kilometers is so extensive and effective that air travel is starting to become obsolete. No country has a dense, large and efficient system of clean public transportation and high-speed rail network as China. In addition, China has the greatest carbon sequestration afforestation program in the world, creating forests the size of Belgium every year. It has doubled its forest coverage to 23% over the past 40 years. Satellite analysis over the past 20 years by the U.S. National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA's Ames Research Laboratory, proves that China has contributed more to greening of the planet than any other country. In other words, by almost every sustainability index, China is a world leader, far ahead of the United States, for example, and is pioneering a way forward for the planet. It will likely hit its targets ahead of time. These things are happening because the Communist Party of China, the CPC, has written sustainability and ecological development directly into its constitution. This is then implemented into regional and local policy, such as sustainable eco-city mandates, transportation policy, energy infrastructure, and advanced research, as well as dedicated funding for alternative energy development for companies to start up and build clean energy technology. These commitments exist despite the fact that China's historical and per capita greenhouse gas emissions and CO2 emissions are a fraction of the world's total. According to the World Bank, on an annual per capita basis, China's share is less than half of the United States. Its household energy consumption is one-eighth of that of the United States. Cumulative historical amounts matter, because carbon dioxide does not dissipate but accrues in the atmosphere. Stocks, not flows, are what matter. In accounting, you look at one's total accrued debt, not one's daily credit expenditures, to determine what he or she owes to others. Likewise, you have to look at historically accrued greenhouse gas emissions to understand harms, liabilities, and mitigation responsibilities accurately. Note also between 14% and 33% of China's annual greenhouse gas emissions are actually the West that have been offshored through manufacturing. This way, the West gets to have its cake and also to eat it. Consume, pollute, and destroy the planet, while virtue signaling and blaming developing countries like China for the cost of Western consumption. Much too has been made of China's coal plants, but the fact is that they are advanced, supercritical or ultra-supercritical plants, which means they are much more efficient and cleaner than many of the industrial-era legacy plants of the United States. China has a more sustainable approach along the entire chain of production and consumption. That said, China understands coal as a transitional source of energy that it wants to phase out, except that the United States has an explicit military plan to choke off China's alternative fuel imports through the South China Sea. China needs to maintain backup capacity in clean coal as it leapfrogs into renewable energy, which will constitute fully 80% of its energy portfolio by 2060. As for funding overseas coal plants, 87% of that finance comes from the West or from Japan, and China has committed not to fund any more foreign coal plants. With these commitments, China has demonstrated that it is dedicated and committed to both national and global sustainability and carbon neutrality. Last, most calculations of greenhouse gas emissions leave out the US military footprint, the single largest institutional emitter in the world, greater than the combined emissions of 140 nations. Add the cost of endless US wars and subtract offshore greenhouse gas emissions from the West from China's total, you get a very different picture of responsibility for global emissions. Despite the hypercritical finger-pointing at China at COP26 summit in Glasgow by the worst polluters, the United States and the West, the simple facts refute the lies. China is a net greenhouse gas creditor nation, not a debtor. The Lancet showed that 92% of emissions above the safe level of 350 parts per million can be attributed to Global North, of which 40% of these emissions are the United States alone. By contrast, China is a net creditor nation. In other words, the atmosphere, atmospheric carrying capacity, a precious global commons, has been colonized and monopolized by the West to the detriment of the rest of the world. In this respect, the United States bears the greatest individual responsibility for the global climate crisis. Despite all of this, China leads in solutions, in technology, in policy, in transition planning, and in implementation. It is not only pulling its weight, it is showing the world a way forward. This is in stark contrast to the United States, where 25% of Congress members still refuse to believe in human-caused climate change, and where the last president claimed that global warming was a Chinese hoax. The United States was also responsible for disabling the original 1997 Kyoto Protocol by lowering standards, engineering carbon indulgences or carbon trading, exempting military emissions, and unjustly trying to offload responsibility to developing nations.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
When one hears the name of the textile industry, the first thing that comes to mind is the multi-billion dollar fashion industry. That's partially true, but it turns out that textiles have many uses outside of the fashion world. They are an important part of the medical field, toy manufacturing, weaponry, agriculture, and other unexpected fields. The Industrial Revolution indeed expanded this industry over the years. All textiles are made of fibers, and innovation, speed, and flexibility have built the spinning sector as we know it.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. This week we will explore the vast textile industry with a particular look at synthetic fibers. We wanted to see where this industry gets its raw material by looking at the contributions of petrochemical sector. We will uncover how synthetic fibers are made and why they are such an integral part of other upstream industries. So let's start spinning this show.
This week, our journey took us to an industrial complex in the town of Karchak near the capital Tehran. We wanted to see who helps tie the textile industry together, so we visited a manufacturer that specializes in producing synthetic threads. Nasojan Parsemehris was first established in 2016, and its main product is polyester thread. Its massive production hall has the capacity to produce tons of this item each day. Its products are sold to numerous textile companies across the nation. Mainly, its customers are manufacturers of fabrics for curtains, upholstery, and the garment industry, to name a few. Production all starts with polyester granules, which are made by the petrochemical industry. Partially oriented yarn is made from this material. Dozens of people are employed at the production lines who work in shifts around the clock. Production never really stops at this facility. Partially oriented yarn is a term used to describe a polyester thread that is not completely stretched. This creates a less uniform appearance and is used to make texture in fabrics. This company makes different types of threads which are used for different purposes in down-the-line industries.
Well, there are two main steps to making polyester thread. In the first step, chips are fed to a machine called the vacuum dryer. After roughly 12 hours, the moisture is reduced and then the material is fed through a hopper to an extruder where it is heated and melted. After other steps, it is fed to a machine for pulling. Each step requires accuracy and precision to make high-quality threads.
The beating heart of this company is the quality control unit. Here, threads are tested for their strength and uniformity based on specifications of its productions. The results are then grouped into three categories based on their quality. The highest grades are then packaged and released into the market. Because of Iran's strategic geographical location, this company easily exports its products to Turkey and competes with other big exporters, such as China and India. This manufacturer's main claim to fame is the high quality of its thread. With such large productions, this company is eyeing the expansion of its production facilities. It has already implemented a second phase of production expansion, and the feasibility study for the third phase is in the works. These developments offer numerous investment opportunities as well. Most of the raw material needed to make polyester threads are domestically produced, with the exception of the spin finishes. The majority of finishes need to be imported. These oils are used because of their properties for increasing thread performance and processability of polyester yarns. These features add value to threads, which makes spin finishes a vital ingredient in the production mix. However, the U.S. imposed sanctions have made importing this item difficult over the years.
Polyester has gained a significant role in the textile industry. Some 50 years ago, cotton was the most important fiber in this industry. But over the years, this changed. Population growth meant prioritizing food crops, which decreased the area for cotton cultivation. So demand for polyester fibers grew such that it is now called the king of fibers in the textile industry.
At present, the most important raw material in the textile industry is polyester. It dominates 60% of material used in the textile production cycle. This is followed by cotton and then a small amount of other natural fibers, such as wool and silk. Other synthetic fibers, such as acrylic, nylon, and polypropylene, are also used in this industry, among others. The main raw material used to make polyester threads are granules, which are produced in large amounts in the petrochemical industry. Domestic polyester granule production is dominated by a handful of companies with a combined annual production of over 420,000 tons. That's according to the Ministry of Industries, Mining and Trade. This amount is largely set for the making of polyester threads and is said to be enough for domestic needs. The petrochemical industry also produces other granules, which are used across almost all industrial sectors. Last year, Iran's total thread production stood at around 48,000 tons. 25% of the raw material used in this production was from cotton. That's based on figures from the National Textile Association. The country makes a lot of cotton, but it is still not nearly enough to meet demands. The domestic demand is roughly around 120,000 tons of cotton annually. This is why local productions last year stood at around 60,000 tons.
Polyester is derived from polymers made by the petrochemical industry. It's not surprising that Iran's polymer industry is exponentially expanding given its large oil reserves. Various manufacturing sectors, such as the textile industry, plastics, and even automobile industry, are heavily dependent on petrochemical products. So how are productions in this sector doing?
Currently, over 6 million tons of polymer products are domestically produced each year. That's based on statistics from the National Plastics and Polymer Industrial Association. Of this amount, some 3 million tons of raw material are exported with a value of $3 billion. The other half of total productions is domestically used to make added value products. These items include polyester string, fabrics, tires, dishes, and containers, and a whole lot more. In total, the association puts the combined exports of petrochemical and polymer products at around $12 billion. Iran's Oil, Gas, and Petrochemical Products Exporters Union predicts an increase in added value of petrochemical products. The union estimates products made from petchems will reach a value of $18 billion in exports by the end of this year. The government has implemented policies and initiatives to increase added value through industries that use these raw materials. All in all, there are numerous opportunities in this sector and the ever-growing textile industry. It is an industry that has built a bridge between past and present with an eye on the future.
It's now time for my colleague on the field to take over the show and teach us all something new. Take it away.
Hi, thanks to the Industrial Revolution, springs began being mass-produced around the turn of the 19th century, paving the way for quick and innovative advancement. An improvement in the production of steel meant that it could be made relatively cheaper, allowing the usage of springs to expand at a rapid pace. In our day-to-day lives, we use a lot of products that utilize springs to achieve their desired motion. What I can think of on the spot are the tiny springs we see in our pens and biros. Now, springs, because of their variety, are also a perfect example of how materials can be manipulated for different applications. Sazeh Fanarpuyesh is one of the big production companies in Iran that specializes in spring manufacturing. The rise of computer-aided design and drafting has made custom-made creations and cutting down on time, energy and waste possible. The same CAD software that can be used to design springs big enough to support entire buildings through an earthquake can also create 30 micrometer sized versions for medical use. A variety of CNC spring machines are used to manufacture extension springs. Now, typically, we use springs to apply an opposing force wherever we need it. Now, in these machines, by making slight adjustments, you can create springs with different tensions in line with the customer's requirements. Variable factors, including wire composition, coil diameter, and the amount of external force, can be changed and calculated automatically to allow designers to come up with suitable, cost and time-efficient manufacturing designs. The coil spring manufacturing process involves feeding a wire into a set of rollers that pull the spring wire into the wire guides. The said wire then comes into contact with a coiling point that coils the wire backwards, forming a pigtail. New discoveries, such as how heat treatment strengthens certain ferrous metals and alloys after being coiled, allows numerous industries to expand the spring's application. A heat treatment oven, and it's the standard equipment in most metalworking facilities. Now, what happens is that springs go into this oven and they are heated to an optimal temperature, and then the cooling process is completely controlled. This helps relieve the stress of the springs. Therefore, it's quite natural that sometimes they are referred to as stress-relieving ovens. Although a spring may seem like a minor component within a large device, functional failure of the spring could result in a device's complete malfunction. Since many products rely on the durability of their springs, it is crucial to select high-quality ones that will not fail prematurely. Typically, springs are tested to ensure their performance. For example, the device we have to my left is a spring fatigue testing machine that measures a spring's ability to withstand forces in a loading cycle. And the one you have behind me ensures the power of a spring, that the spring can deliver what it says it will. And of course, the device is a salt spray testing device that actually tests the durability of the spring's coating. Protective coatings are often the most cost-effective method to prolong spring life in corrosive environments. Spring versatility suggests that the manufacture and use of spring technology isn't going to slow down anytime soon. past few decades, the demand for minuscule springs has risen dramatically because of their use in mobile phones, touchpads, and, of course, other modern electronic devices. So even after thousands of years of evolution, spring technology could have a future that's completely different to what it is today. Who knows, maybe even 4D printing and 2D materials will play a hand in it.
Thank you for that amazing reporting. We're just about out of time, but before we go, let's check out some news and trends in the textile industry. Ever wanted a pair of socks that remain odor-free? Well, an Iranian knowledge-based company which specializes in making nanotextiles has been producing them for years and is now exporting this product.
This company makes a special textile used in these socks, which is antibacterial, antifungal, and anti-odor. This product was mainly produced for diabetic patients who are susceptible to foot ulcers. Recently, this company began exporting its nano socks to neighboring countries as well as European states. Last year, some 8,000 pairs of these advanced socks were exported to Britain alone. Iran has made big advancements in the field of nanotechnology and is ranked fourth in the world for its high-quality nanotech products.
As you know, sportswear is a hot topic as many people are aiming to reach their fitness goals and stay healthy. Now, a special type of fabric has been created for the first time in Iran, which has cooling properties and is used to make activewear.
An Iranian knowledge-based company used nanotechnology to produce nylon fabrics that cool down the body by reflecting infrared radiation. These nanocomposite fabrics have many functions, including eliminating odors, rapid drying, and increasing blood circulation. The product received nanoscale certification from the National Headquarters of Nanotech Development 2 years ago. It is now part of the Healthex fabric collection manufactured at this nano company.
Silk thread produced in Iran has been used to make clothing fabric and for weaving Persian rugs for millennia. And ancient methods of silk making are still alive among many village communities across Iran.
Traditional silk makers are mainly located in northern Gilan and northeastern Khorasan Razavi provinces. These communities make a living off of this trade the same way their ancestors did some 3,000 years ago. They get their silk cocoons in wooden boxes, mainly from the northern provinces. The cocoons are soaked in hot water to loosen the filaments. Then the threads are hand-spun around spindles. It's a labor-intensive process that can take up to 12 hours to produce 1 kilogram of this valuable thread. While this process has become fully mechanized in many factories, traditional spinning methods still continue in these villages. These activities also offer interesting attractions for tourists.
And that covers our program for today. Let us know what you think about this industry by dropping us a line via email. Also, thank you so much for all the feedback on our Instagram page. Thank you for tuning in.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters. 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.